Gerdes und ich freuen uns, dass wir Sie im März, am 5. März heute Abend begrüßen können. Wir haben hier eine kleine Premiere und zumindest ich bin auch schon ein bisschen aufgeregt, wie das wird. Sie sehen den Titel, die Ankündigung in englischer Sprache. Und in der Tat ist es heute unser erster ausländischer Gast, den wir mit einem ganz spannenden Thema haben, nämlich die Schwangerschaft bei den chronisch entzündlichen Hauterkrankungen, zum Beispiel Schuppenflechte, Neurodermitis und vielleicht auch ein bisschen ein Ausblick auf die Hidradenitis. Also zumindest Schwangerschaft und Systemtherapien kommen heute vor. Und da freuen wir uns, dass wir Dr. Osema Etomi begrüßen können aus London. Ich werde sie gleich noch genau vorstellen und selbstverständlich in Englisch. Sie weiß aber auch, und sie ist schon online, dass wir beginnen wie immer mit unseren Derma-News. Und bevor wir das tun und Sascha Gerdes damit startet, vielleicht noch wieder der Hinweis von uns, das Derma at Home für die, die sich neu zuschalten. Ihre Sendung ist, Sie haben eine Chatfunktion an Ihrem virtuellen Browser und die müssen Sie aktivieren. Melden Sie sich bitte mit vollem Vor- und Zunamen an, dass wir Sie dann auch ansprechen können. Und bitte schreiben Sie Ihre Fragen, Ihre Kommentare, die Sie während des Vortrags haben, in diese Chatfunktion. Sascha wird heute den Chat betreuen und wird dann die Fragen sehen und sie dann, wenn es dringend ist, während des Vortrags, aber in der Regel nach dem Vortrag mit Ihnen abarbeiten und vor allen Dingen mit unserer Gastreferentin und was noch an Fragen übrig bleibt, das erledigen wir nach unserem formalen und tschüss um 21 Uhr dann noch in der Speakers Corner. So viel zum Einstand und jetzt hören und sehen wir die Derma News.
Ja, herzlich willkommen auch von meiner Seite. Ich darf heute anfangen mit den Derma News. Wir haben ein paar Themen für Sie mitgebracht und ich möchte Ihnen ein Thema heute vorstellen, was ein eher seltenes Thema ist, nämlich die tuberöse Sklerose. Und ich habe das nochmal herausgegriffen, weil wir jüngst selbst so einen Patienten in der Sprechstunde hatten und es eine einigermaßen noch neue Therapieoptionen nämlich jetzt gibt zur Verfügung und darauf gehe ich gleich nochmal ein. Die tuberöse Sklerose ist ja ein genetisches, multisystemisches, autosomal dominant vererbtes Fehlbildungssyndrom. Es kommt so ungefähr 1 zu 6.000 oder 1 zu 10.000 in der Häufigkeit vor. Und die typischen Hautveränderungen, die wir sehen, sind zum Beispiel ja die Eschenlaubflecken, aber auch vor allem die facialen Angiofibrome oder die Köhn-Tumoren. Als Ursache wissen wir, dass es ein Hamatom ist. Es sind Genveränderungen bekannt in zwei Genen, dem TSC1 und 2-Gen, das einmal für das Hamatin und das Tuberin kodiert. Das ist ein Proteinkomplex, wo beide diese Proteine funktionieren müssen und sich zusammenlagern. Und egal eben, ob in dem einen oder dem anderen Gen die Mutation ist, es kommt dann zum Ausfall dieses Proteinkomplexes. Und er ist physiologischerweise dafür zuständig, den mTOR-Komplex negativ zu regulieren. Und wenn das eben ausfällt, dann kommt es zu Zellwachstum oder einer Fehlregulation auch der Zellgröße. Und das erklärt dann eben auch im Hautbereich die Veränderung, die wir vornehmlich eben ja auch im zentrofazialen Gesicht mit den Angiofibromen sehen. Und für diese facialen Angiofibrome gibt es ein mTOR-Inhibitor, nämlich das Sirolimus, jetzt auch als Fertigpräparat, was wir rezeptieren können. Hier ist der Handelsname einmal aufgeschrieben, weil es nur dieses eine Produkt gibt. Es heißt Hyftor, 2 Milligramm pro Gramm Gel. Und man kann es ab 6 Jahren zur Behandlung eben dieser facialen Angiofibrome bei tuberöser Sklerose ganz normal rezeptieren. Und es wird 2-mal täglich auf die betroffenen Stellen aufgetragen. Das Ganze ist in Studien untersucht. Ich habe hier eine Abbildung mitgebracht aus Japan war diese Studie. Und man sieht hier tatsächlich in der Abbildung, dass gemessen an einem Erfolg, einem sehr ausgeprägten Erfolg, einem mittleren Erfolg oder auch einem geringen Erfolg, man eigentlich sieht, dass das Sirolimus-Gel eben in diesen Erfolgskategorien wirksam ist, während das Placebo eben nicht wirksam war, maximal so eine ganz leichte Verbesserung gesehen werden konnte. Und somit hat sich das hier wirklich so bewahrheitet, dass es dann auch zur Zulassung dieses mTOR-Inhibitors als Fertigarzneimittel gekommen ist. So, wusstest du das, Uli?
Nein, tatsächlich nicht. Nein. Üftor ist auch neu für mich und ich habe allerdings noch keinen Patienten vor Augen. Ich habe eine Patientin lange Jahre betreut in unserer Lasersprechstunde, wo wir das mit dem Farbstofflaser behandelt haben. Aber nein, aber super Option.
Ja, ich fand es auch nochmal ganz spannend, weil sonst haben wir immer diskutiert, kann man nicht Sirolimus oder sowas einsetzen. Ja. Und jetzt gibt es eben dieses Fertigprodukt und wir können es benutzen.
Ja, liebe KollegInnen, von mir gibt es heute was ganz Spezielles. Wir leben ja in ganz besonderen Zeiten. Und da habe ich mir überlegt, es wäre vielleicht mal ganz gut, über Glück zu sprechen. Und über das Glücklichsein in Deutschland. Und Anlass ist ein Vortrag, den ich selber gehört habe von Professor Raffelhüschen aus Freiburg und hat ein paar Daten dort präsentiert. Die habe ich Ihnen auch nochmal rausgeholt aus dem sogenannten SKL-Glücksatlas, der Ende letzten Jahres erschienen ist. Und dann sehen Sie, dass wir eigentlich gar nicht so unglücklich sind. Und Sie sehen auch, dass in den Anfang der 20er Jahre das Glücklichsein in Deutschland durchaus immer besser geworden ist, bis Corona kam. Und dann sehen Sie diese große Corona-Delle nach unten. Und wir sind fast wieder auf dem Höchststand, auf dem Höchstwert, den wir 2019 vor Beginn der Corona-Krise hatten. Also so schlimm kann es mit uns nicht stehen. Wir Deutschen neigen ja zu einer gewissen Melancholie und zu hängenden Mundwinkeln. Aber Sie sehen, das ist gar nicht so schlecht. Wie ist die Zufriedenheit in den verschiedenen Bereichen. Und da ist vielleicht ein Augenmerk zu richten auf die hellblaue Kurve. Mal gucken, ob ich das hier zeigen kann. Genau, das ist diese hier. Da geht es nämlich um die Gesundheit. Und Sie sehen, dass selbst hier nach Corona die Zufriedenheit mit der Gesundheit eigentlich permanent angestiegen ist. Hier bleibt sie so ein bisschen auf Niveau. Aber auch hier ist offensichtlich kein Grund dafür vorhanden, mit der Gesundheit in Deutschland auch im letzten Jahr nicht zufrieden zu sein. Und da ist das nochmal gemarkert, das ist das, was ich gerade gezeigt hatte. So, negative, positive Emotionen, Ärger, Traurigkeit, Glück. Und Sie sehen, dass hier die Emotionen sich etwas verändert haben, aber auch insgesamt im Vergleich 23/24 ist sowohl das Glück gestiegen, als auch der Ärger leicht angestiegen. Und das ist vielleicht etwas, was wir uns mal überlegen sollten, ob das Glück nicht dann vielleicht doch den Ärger überwiegt. Auf jeden Fall sind die Balken hier sehr viel größer beim Glück. Und auch das zeigt wieder, dass wir eigentlich, auch wenn wir uns ärgern, auch wenn jetzt die Angst in der momentanen weltpolitischen Situation zunimmt, wir immer noch eigentlich recht glücklich sind. Und am Ende möchte ich Ihnen nochmal den Glücksatlas zeigen, das Glücksranking. Sie sehen, die glücklichsten Menschen in Deutschland leben dort, wo die Farbe dunkelblau ist. Und das ist natürlich wie immer hier oben im Norden, Hamburg und Schleswig-Holstein. Aber der Süden hat aufgeholt. Bayern und Schleswig-Holstein liegen jetzt gleich auf hinter Hamburg. Hamburg ist jetzt die Nummer 1 2021. Und Sie sehen, dass auch in anderen Ländern das Glück gar nicht so schlecht vertreten ist. Und mit diesem positiven Ausblick möchte ich eigentlich die Derma News beenden. Und ich werde jetzt auf Englisch überwechseln. Und dear colleagues, we are very, very pleased that for the first time at Derma at Home, we will have an English lecture. And the reason is that I was able to listen to Osemi Itomi, our guest speaker today, at the World Conference of Psoriatic Arthritis and Psoriasis in Stockholm in July last year. And she gave a lecture about pregnancy and how to deal with pregnancy in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. And this lecture was extremely highly rated among all the participants. And at the next day, we met each other at a big party. And I asked Osemi about, I informed her about our format, Derma at Home, and I asked her if she will be able to deliver this lecture to us. And she, in a second, accepted this invitation. I'm very happy. Dr. Itomi is a rheumatologist, but she's also trained in obstetrics. So she is bridging rheumatology and the theme of today, the issue pregnancy, very, very well. She works in London at the Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital, where there is a hotspot of taking care about inflammatory diseases. And Osemi, thank you very much for joining us. And the stage is yours now.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel very honored to be invited, and I hope I don't let you down. So welcome from London. And this statue that is in my presentation actually stands in King's Hospital, which is in the same trust, where we look after women with pregnancy and medical conditions. And my main interest is in inflammatory conditions in pregnancy. I've put my email address just at the bottom in case people have questions or would like to make contact. In terms of my conflicts of interest, I have had funds from UCB and Celtrion in terms of speaker fees and consultations. In terms of an overview of this talk, I'm just going to give a background first of all, and then really to drill down on the principles when treating inflammatory disease in pregnancy. Then I'd like to go into psoriatic disease and really focus on all the different stages of pregnancy. Also, how we can learn from each other, from dermatology to rheumatology, gastroenterology, and instead of in reinventing the wheel, how we can learn from each other and make sure that we are giving our patients the best care and that we're all on the same page. And then I'm going to touch on conditions like hidradenitis suppurativa and atopic dermatitis before we close up. So, in terms of background, psoriatic disease affects women of childbearing age, which I'm sure you are aware of. But actually, psoriasis is more than just the skin. Of course, this is what people will manifest externally, and it's the most obvious aspect of the disease for many. But, I'm a rheumatologist and I see many patients who have coexisting joint disease. I see patients who have joint disease before their skin disease develops. They may also have nail changes, may have eye involvement. These patients are often very metabolic, and often there's strong associations with depressive illnesses with conditions like psoriasis. But much more than, the skin or the other organs that involves, it involves people. And a lot of people, especially of childbearing age, one of the things that they would like to think about, like to experience, and also adds to the fullness of their life is often thinking about families and planning for families, and that includes having a pregnancy. So, as I said, we know that 50-50 representation between men and women with psoriasis and psoriatic disease. We know that the peak age of onset is often during the childbearing years, so somewhere between 15 and 35. And yet, we also know that about 50% of our pregnancies with rheumatic conditions remain unplanned. Now, patients, a lot of patients are not planning for pregnancy, but actually, what is clear is they spend a lot of time worrying about family planning, worrying about what will happen. And what we find is that two in three patients or women of childbearing age with chronic rheumatic disease will worry about family planning. So what does an unplanned pregnancy look like? Well, first of all, when I was a registrar, and even now in my clinical practice, I'm asked to come down to counsel women who have had accidental pregnancies whilst on medications that may have bad implications for those pregnancies, things like methotrexate. Also, we know that if you have an unplanned pregnancy, then you increase your risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes, things like rates of pregnancy-induced hypertension or preeclampsia, things like fetal growth restriction, early losses or recurrent miscarriages, and also the risk of premature delivery and the sequelae that entails. If you deliver early, then your risk of neurological, neurocognitive impairment is higher. And sometimes when I counsel women about pregnancy and their autoimmune disease, a lot of patients have this feeling that it's a black and white. Either I'll have a healthy live baby at the end of this, or I'll have no baby at all. And that's just not true. There's a real gray area where you see the baby on the far left is a baby that is growth restricted. So born early and very small premature baby. What you also see is the baby in the middle is born at the same time as the normal-sized baby, but because of poor placental function, poor perfusion, this baby is small and growth restricted. And when we have especially inflammatory systemic conditions, we find that the rates of small for gestational age and growth-restricted babies is increased. So what is the impact of having a chronic inflammatory disease on family planning? Well, what we know is that many patients will actually have voluntary childlessness. So over half our patients decide to have fewer children than they would if they were compared to patients who did not have those diseases. And many patients report reduced fertility, subfertility, infertility after diagnosis. We also know that the patients with inflammatory disease are more likely to not just limit their family size, but it's the worry about being able to care for a child when they have an active disease, when they're in and out of hospital on various medications. They're also concerned about the implications of the medications on the developing fetus, and also whether they will pass these conditions on to their offspring. But also, what we find is that there's a real mismatch. So many of our patients are worrying about family planning, but actually, many of our clinicians are not upskilled to give that adequate family planning. Up to 50% felt that they did not have their concerns adequately addressed by healthcare professionals. And about 50%, 30 to 50%, felt that the advice was inconsistent. So again, we need to get on the same team sheet because sometimes your rheumatologist has told you something, your dermatologist has told you something else, perhaps your gastroenterologist something else again. So let's think about the principles of treating inflammatory disease in pregnancy. And if you remember nothing else from this talk, I would like you to just remember that disease control is key. And disease control is key in all stages of pregnancy, preconception, during the pregnancy, and after. So this is a cohort of patients with rheumatoid arthritis looking at their disease activity score. And we're looking at their time to conception. Right at the top in the blue line are patients with high disease activity. And you can see that about 67% of them would not achieve pregnancy within the first year. If you are a normal, healthy person of childbearing age, 80% of patients or people should achieve a pregnancy within the first year of unprotected sex. So this is a significant number who are reporting subfertility or infertility because of high disease activity. And what you see in the converse line is that as you lower the disease activity, you improve the chances of getting pregnant.
Oseme, I'm sorry
Oh,
to
sorry.
I'm very sorry to interrupt you, but your line is very, very bad at the moment, and
Right.
we can hardly understand you. So our technique team ask you to restart, to redial in, because otherwise it would be very, very sad that we cannot really follow your lecture.
I'm so sorry.
No,
I'll maybe
that
try.
sometimes happens, but it's probably better you leave the virtual platform, redial, and then we hope that it will be better.
Okay.
Ja, das kann passieren, liebe Kolleginnen und Kollegen. Das ist nicht nur über den englischen Kanal hinüber. Das haben wir ja auch schon manchmal gehabt, wenn wir das aus Deutschland hatten, dass mal die Leitung einfach nicht so gut ist, wie sie am Anfang war und wir das nicht vorherbestimmen können, weil wir ja in dem Studio hier zwar optimale Verhältnisse haben, aber wir wissen manchmal nicht, wo unsere ReferentInnen sitzen und Sie wissen alle, dass manchmal das Handynetz oder das Zugangsnetz zum Internet wackelt, wie man so schön sagt. Und die Situation haben wir hier. Wie hat dir denn der Vortrag bisher gefallen, Sascha?
Ja, sehr gut. Ich finde wir verlieren ja manchmal die Perspektive so leicht aus dem Auge, wenn man eben Frauen oder Familien im gebärfähigen Alter behandelt, hat man immer nur seinen Fokus auf, welches Medikament darf ich geben, welches nicht. Aber diese ganzen Sorgen und Nöte, die da mitschwingen, eigentlich bei den Betroffenen, ist ja nochmal Wahnsinn. Also, dass zwei Drittel sozusagen der Frauen eigentlich diese Probleme sehen im gebärfähigen Alter, dass sie da ganz viele Probleme fokussieren, wenn sie schwanger werden wollen. Das fand ich jetzt schon nochmal sehr bemerkenswert.
Das ist eine große Zahl. Und Dr. Itomi hat ja am Anfang gesagt, wir müssen den Menschen hinter der Krankheit sehen. Und ich glaube, das war so ein Statement, was genau in diese Richtung geht, wie du das eben gesagt hast, dass natürlich Familienplanung, Partnerwahl und vieles andere durch so eine Erkrankung ja nicht dem entspricht, was vielleicht gesunde Menschen tun und lassen würden. Und dass wir als ÄrztInnen daran denken, ist, glaube ich, enorm wichtig. Sie hat ja viele Beispiele aus der Rheumatologie genannt, aber sie hat dann auch eben gesagt, dass die Dermatologie genau das gleiche Problem hat. So, wir haben, höre ich gerade, Osemi wieder online.
Are you back? Yes.
I come back. Hello. Can you hear me better?
Slightly.
But we'll try
to. But you know, we'll fix it. Otherwise, for the podcast later on, I would suggest you just continue with your presentation now.
Okay. Shall I start at the beginning, maybe?
Once again.
Or carry on.
Carry on.
Carry on from where I left off.
What you can do. Potentially is that you shut off your camera. That sometimes helps for the tone to be better.
Yeah.
And then start at the slide where you just stopped.
Okay.
Showing the graph.
Yeah.
That okay. Looks good.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's much better now.
Yes, sounds good.
Fantastic. Okay. So the main point I'm trying to make is that disease control is the most important thing when you have patients with inflammatory disease in pregnancy. And we see this preconception. We also see this during the pregnancy and after as well. So this graph really talks us through patients with rheumatoid arthritis, looking at their disease activity score. And what you find is that if you have high disease activity, you delay the time to conception. So at the top of the graph is patients with high disease activity score, and 67% of these patients were not able to achieve pregnancy during the first year of active unprotected sex. And you see that that number falls as the disease activity improves, but even when they have good disease activity, around 30% of patients do not achieve pregnancy within a year of unprotected sex. This is compared to a normal population where you should expect to see about 80% of patients getting pregnant. So only about 15 to 20% will struggle with not getting pregnant in the first year with having unprotected sex. And what you also see is that untreated disease is associated with poor obstetric outcomes. This is looking at rates of preterm delivery, small for gestational age, and the need for cesarean section delivery, with the patients in the blue having good disease control, and with the patients, with patients in the blue having active disease, and patients in the orange having better disease control. This again, different disease, but similar story, is patients with lupus, and looking at patients in the red with active lupus and patients in the blue with no or low disease activity. And again, you see that the rates of perinatal death, prematurity, growth restriction, and also your chance of having a live baby is affected by whether the disease is active or under control. In the UK, we have a confidential inquiry into maternal deaths, and the deaths are sort of studied in a cycle of 3 years. And what you see is that patients with untreated disease also have poor maternal outcomes. This is looking at COVID-19, and essentially in the deaths from 2020 to 2022, we found that COVID-19 deaths were related in about 14% of all the pregnancies. And many of these patients who had COVID and did badly were patients who did not have conventional treatments like steroids or immunosuppressive agents like tocilizumab. Many of these patients did not have vaccinations either. So again, not treating patients can be associated with poor maternal outcomes, not just fetal outcomes. Now, how can we improve care for women of childbearing age? And what we really need to do is start considering all our patients pre-pregnant. So anyone who is of childbearing age should be considered pre-pregnant so that we don't miss the opportunity for them to have optimal control before entering into the pregnancy. So we're going to just think about the pre-pregnancy phase, the pregnancy phase, and also considerations in the post-pregnancy phase. Well, in terms of pre-pregnancy, then we need to talk to our patients about sex. We need to address their comorbidities. We need to offer them long-acting reversible contraception if we want them to have the opportunity to have a planned pregnancy. And we also need to be offering them pre-pregnancy counseling. So let's talk about sex. Sex contributes significantly to people's quality of life, their identity, and overall how they experience life. There are many barriers to sex for patients, especially things like active disease. When you're not well, your sexual function may be impaired. When you have skin disease, it significantly might affect your body image. But also, as clinicians, we have barriers to talking about sex, whether that's perception, this is not my job, whether that's I'm very pressed for time and I don't have enough time to see all my patients and talk about their disease, let alone their sex life. And sometimes these things can be embarrassing. What we understand also is that, especially in dermatology, I think you guys are really leading the way with some of this. And there are some increasing genital clinics. And sometimes that might be a more appropriate place for people to talk about their sexual function or dysfunction. And there are also screening tools that can help you when trying to assess patients with psoriatic disease and their sex lives. It's really important to address their comorbidities in the pre-pregnancy phase. We know that psoriatic patients are very metabolic, risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, associations with polycystic kidneys and polycystic ovarian syndrome, which essentially can increase your risks in the pregnancy. We also know that these patients have premature cardiovascular disease, hypertensive disorders, there's a strong association with smoking, and also, like I touched on before, the mental health component with depression and anxiety. Again, I think dermatologists are really ahead of the game in this. You know, patients who are needing sort of treatment for acne, for example, will be put onto contraception, will have to have pregnancy tests to make sure that they're able to continue to have the medications. But really, we should be offering all our patients with inflammatory conditions long-acting reversible contraception. This is contraception that is reliable and lasts a long time, often months to years. We're mainly talking about four forms of contraception, including the implant, the contraceptive injection, the intrauterine systems, whether that be a copper coil or an intrauterine system, which is based with a small amount of progesterone. And what we know is that when you look at the failure rate for all of these forms of contraception, it is very low. It's less than 1%. And actually, the Nexplanon is actually more effective than sterilization, where we quote a rate of 1 in 200 for women who, in terms of failure rate. These patients should be offered an opportunity to sit down and have counseling, allowing them to understand their disease, understand the implications in pregnancy, allow them to review their medications and optimize their medications, and also to address their comorbidities. What we see is that patients who haven't had that counseling can do worse. So if you stop your medication at conception because you've not been told whether it's safe or unsafe, you're likely or more likely to flare. So this is looking at patients who are on anti-TNF, who discontinued their therapy as they got pregnant, and you see that their risk of flare is about 3.3-fold higher. This is the document that I often refer to. It's a very nice, very simple document, very easy to follow, and gives practical advice on how to manage pregnancy in rheumatic disease. And I would refer you to look at this article. But essentially, a lot of what we talk about when we're counseling these women is about shared decision making. So giving them that information and they make the best decision for them. Some patients will always elect to have no medication in pregnancy. Some patients will elect not to have families at all, but at least they're making it from a place of informed choice. So, thinking about pregnancy, then I'm going to touch on three things. Let's think about disease activity, let's think about medication use, and let's think about how we can learn from our colleagues. So, when you look at women with inflammatory rheumatic disease, you see that it's not this old story of if you have inflammatory arthritis, you'll go into remission, you don't need your medications, you'll be fine. What we see is that with patients with rheumatoid, about 54% improve during pregnancy, which is almost half don't improve. And with Angspond, 40% improve, which means that about 60% do not improve during the pregnancy. What we know is that if you have low disease activity going into the pregnancy, you're more likely to maintain that low disease activity state. One in three patients with psoriatic arthritis will have disease activity. So you see that many patients with psoriatic arthritis will have improved states, will have stable states, but you see that up to a third will have high disease or worsening disease activity during the pregnancy. So again, this is not a time when you want them to be stopping their medication. It's a time when you want to be seeing them and making sure that everything is okay. There are many medications that are compatible with pregnancy, and I hope with increasing confidence that you have, the confidence to use medications in pregnancy. Things like prednisolone, hydroxychloroquine, sulfasalazine, azathioprine, cyclosporine have good supportive data to say periconception, first, second trimester, third trimester, and also in breastfeeding, they are safe and compatible. What we see is that methotrexate is not safe throughout any gestation of pregnancy, but in terms of the rheumatology guidance, we say that it is now safe to stop 1 month before conceiving a child if you have been exposed to methotrexate. All my patients with methotrexate, I offer high dose folic acid, 5 milligrams every day for 3 months before they conceive. And patients with sulfasalazine as well, I offer them 5 milligrams a day in the preconception and in the first trimester as well. So let's think about biologics. Now, biologics are large molecules. And I've put this here just to see how large I'm talking about. So aspirin is about 180 kilodaltons. Monoclonal antibodies and your biologics will be about 150,000 kilodaltons. What that means is that these molecules do not pass freely across the placenta. And that's a really important mechanism to understand when counseling patients about medications, when thinking about newer medications that our patients may be on, and thinking about pregnancy. So, this slide is looking at transport across the placenta in terms of IV IgG molecules or biologic medications. And what you see is that you need an Fc receptor on the placenta to transport these medications actively across from the maternal circulation in the right to the fetal circulation in the left. So in the first trimester, no medications pass over to the fetus. And that's really important because what that means is that these medications are not associated with teratogenicity. In the second trimester, you start to get some Fc receptors on the placenta, and so you get some of the medication that will be passed across to the fetus. Now, because of this mechanism we call active transport, as the placenta is maturing, as the fetus is maturing, they will be exposed to more and more and more biologic medications. And if you think about it, that's because your child needs your immune system when it's first born and it hasn't got its own, so it relies on maternal antibodies. And most of these are passed along through IgG, through transport in that placenta. So by the third trimester, your fetus will be exposed to more medication. Now, what do we know about anti-TNFs? Basically, anti-TNFs, I would say, are compatible with pregnancy. We've used them for a long time, and we have increasing confidence to support that use. So the things to remember are, I don't switch biologics or anti-TNF based on satralizumab not being absorbed throughout any stage of pregnancy. If you are stable on an anti-TNF, I continue. I do not switch. I use the same approach with biosimilars, and I generally will continue most of these patients in the third trimester because the risk of flare is greater than the risk posed by the treatment. Other commonly biologics used, including ustekinumab, secukinumab, things like risankinumab, again, similar mechanisms of action don't pass across in the first trimester, and we have more and more confidence to say that these medications are also compatible in pregnancy. Learning from some friends, so I run an inflammatory bowel disease in pregnancy clinic, and we never stop biologics in the third trimester for our patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. And that's because the disease is quite often likely to flare, and when it flares, it can be really very nasty. So none of the anti-TNFs, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, we continue through all trimesters. And what this study is showing, this systematic review is showing, is that the patients exposed to anti-TNF in the third trimester compared to patients who stopped in the second trimester had similar outcomes with their babies. Again, this is the piano registry data looking at, biologics and thiopurines in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And again, we see very similar outcomes. The patients where we see different outcomes are when the disease is active, and that is associated with preterm birth, with spontaneous abortions as well. Women with inflammatory rheumatic disease, inflammatory systemic disease, should be offered low-dose aspirin because we believe that it helps with the implantation phase of the placenta. We believe it helps with perfusion to the baby. We believe it helps prevent or reduce the risk of preeclampsia. We generally offer between 75 and 100 milligrams of aspirin. And if you're going to start aspirin, we generally start it before 16 weeks. So in the post-pregnancy phase, we're just going to think about flares postpartum. We're going to think about postpartum depression, and I'm going to also touch on breastfeeding and vaccinations. So in the postpartum phase, flares are common. Most commonly patients with axial spondylitis, but also with patients with rheumatoid, and about 40% of patients with psoriatic disease will flare. Sometimes the problem is that these patients don't have adequate follow-up with rheumatology. They're not going back to obstetrics, and they sort of can get a bit stuck. I often say that I offer these patients, sorry, I often offer these patients a telephone follow-up because it can be quite difficult actually to it can be quite difficult to bring someone up to hospital with their young baby. You know, it can be really difficult and challenging. But I offer a telephone follow-up, and this can be done with your specialist nurses. It doesn't have to be you doing all of these check-ins with these patients, but I think it is a very useful thing. What we also know is that postnatal depression kills. So a big part of women who die postpartum seems to be related to mental health disease due to problems like postpartum depression and puerperal psychosis. We already know that many of our psoriatic patients are vulnerable, and again, that's why it is useful to check in with these patients after they've delivered, because actually, you know these patients very well. And it can be easy to say, she's not herself. There's something wrong. I need to escalate to someone who can help. In terms of breastfeeding, there are significant benefits to the baby and the mom. What we know is that there is limited information regarding medications and breastfeeding. Medications like azathioprine, sulfasalazine, biologics are deemed to be safe. We do not stop these medications from women who are breastfeeding. We have poor data to support methotrexate and MMF in pregnancy or in breastfeeding, but actually it doesn't, the studies are not very good at all, and we just need better studies to know whether we can encourage women to breastfeed whilst on these medications. I've had women, for example, on mycophenolate who have chosen to breastfeed and their babies have not had any active problems. Just remember about the risk of osteoporosis. Patients with inflammatory disease are at risk of osteoporosis, patients on long-term steroids, but also the pregnancy for itself will reduce your bone density and cause a temporary menopause, which is reversible post-breastfeeding. If you are high risk with other risk factors, I don't encourage these women to breastfeed exclusively for anything more than 6 months. In terms of live vaccine updates, so historically, we were told that live vaccine could be avoided with patients who've been exposed to biologic medications. What we know now is that there are many patients who tolerate the rotavirus absolutely fine if their mothers had biologics when they were in the womb. So I do not withhold rotavirus from any of these patients. There are other vaccinations they can also have as normal. What I do is avoid the BCG vaccination for the first 6 months if you've been exposed to biologics in the third trimester. I avoid the BCG vaccine for 12 months if you've been exposed to infliximab, because we know that infliximab has a long half-life and will have some traces within the fetal system for much longer than the other biologics that we use. Very briefly, I'm going to touch on other conditions, including hidradenitis and atopic dermatitis. So HS is common and affects up to 1 in 100 patients or people. In terms of the literature, there are various reports, but somewhere between 30% and 50% are reported to have no change in their disease during pregnancy. The worst outcomes I could find suggested that up to 60% in a small cohort had worsening disease during their pregnancy. But overall, most patients, I would say, have stable or improvement in their disease. There are many treatments that are well tolerated and compatible with pregnancy, and this includes the anti-TNFs, which we already talked about. What I would say is that, especially with patients who have perianal pelvic disease, I would not stop their treatments. I would not stop their anti-TNFs in the third trimester due to the risk of flares. Many patients with HS can have a normal vaginal delivery, but I would consider this actively on a case-by-case basis, especially patients who have active disease around the time that they are delivering, especially if that disease is in the perineal and perianal region because of the risk of tears. If in doubt, you can always sort of request things like an MRI of the pelvis. MRI is safe in pregnancy as long as it's used without gadolinium. Thinking about atopic dermatitis, then it is common in pregnancy, and about 80% are said to be de novo during that pregnancy. What you find is that the 20% of patients with pre-existing disease, about 30 to 40% of them will get worse. About half of them will be the same or stable disease. And about 20% are said to regress during the pregnancy. This is a really nice review article in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. And what it does is it looks at all the treatments that you use for AD and thinking about whether they are compatible with pregnancy in the preconception and in the pregnancy phase. Green is good, red is bad, and yellow, amber is somewhere in between. Well, lots of topical treatments, very safe, very compatible, no restrictions at all. Generally, we avoid PUVA for these patients, but you can use UVA1, you can use broad or narrow band UVB therapy. Things like cyclosporine, safe, azathioprine, safe and compatible. Of course, we've already talked about methotrexate. For us, we safe in rheumatology, we now advise patients 1 month. I know my dermatology colleagues are doing something different, but I'm trying to convince them that 1 month is actually plenty. There are no restrictions with dupilumab. I have lots of patients with dupilumab. I have no concerns with dupilumab and exposure during pregnancy. And again, remember those smaller molecules, your upadacitinib, your baricitinib, small molecules can transfer across the placenta through any stage of the pregnancy. So at the moment, we are saying that it is contraindicated. We do not advise women to get pregnant on these molecules, although we are starting to get some real-world data saying it actually seems not to be as bad. But watch this space and, we'll come with updates once we have more information. So I'm just going to end the talk there. And really what I'm going to say is that psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis affect a high proportion of women of childbearing age. Many of our patients have unplanned pregnancy, and I think there is a big opportunity for us to engage these patients, optimize their disease, and give them the right tools and empowerment to stay on appropriate treatment. Remember that severe disease activity is associated with poor outcomes for the mum and the baby. And I think we can really start to work together to improve these outcomes for our women of childbearing age. Let's learn from each other. And I'm going to leave it there and then take some questions. Thank you.
Oseme, we are sorry for the technical problems, and unfortunately, we are a little bit over our normal time where we say goodbye. But we have spent this extra 3 minutes to complete your talk, and we asked you to stay online for the speaker's corner because we will address the incoming questions in our discussion in the speaker's corner. And now I will hand over to Sasha. For the farewell and for the announcement for the next meeting.
Yes, thank you very much from my side too. And we will chat in the speaker's corner in a minute. Ja, vielen Dank, liebe Kollegen, dass Sie heute diesen ersten englischen Vortrag bei uns mit angehört haben. Sie dürfen gleich gerne noch alle, die heute live anwesend sind in der Speaker's Corner, Ihre Fragen auch gerne auf Deutsch schreiben. Wir übersetzen es dann. Aber nach dem Derma at Home ist vor dem Derma at Home. Wir treffen uns wieder am 2. April. Dann wird Professor Falk Bicharra da sein und uns zur Hidradenitis suppurativa ein Update geben. Das ist ja auch eine chronisch entzündliche Hauterkrankung, wo sehr viele Aktivitäten im Moment vorhanden sind. Und wir sind uns sicher, dass Herr Bicharra uns da wieder viele Neuigkeiten präsentieren wird. In diesem Sinne wollen wir uns ganz herzlich bedanken, dass Sie heute wieder live dabei waren, die Sie am Bildschirm sind. Wie gesagt, Sie bleiben gerne dabei für die Fragen in der Speakers Corner und unsere Zuhörer im Podcast verabschieden wir auch bis zum nächsten Mal und verbleiben damit aus Kiel mit dem Bekannten
und tschüss.
Und tschüss.